I'm sure you've all had the experience one time or another when you've prepared for a long journey. Maybe you've travelled on holiday abroad and you might be catching a ferry or an aeroplane. And in order to plan a journey properly, you need to have a starting point and you need to have an end point, and that helps you to understand the path that you will take in between. And it was no different for the Israelites. They had a starting point, and which was in Egypt when they were rescued. There's an end point to their journey, which is coming to the promised land. And there's a pathway in between that God wants them to follow. Now, sometimes on a journey, you may lose your bearings. You get lost. You lose your map, or you have it upside down. You take a wrong turning. And you need to gain your bearings again. You need to find out where you are, where you've gone wrong, so that you can start on the right direction again. I once climbed up Ben Nevis with my family, and it was fine going up. It was nice and clear and bright. We reached the top eventually. On the way down, suddenly clouds descended on the mountain, and the group got separated. So my eldest brother and sister got separated from the rest of us, and we didn't see them until everyone got to the bottom of the mountain, and we were, the rest of us were walking along until suddenly I saw my mum walk into a cloud, and that was the last I saw of her until we got to the bottom of the mountain. And I have this memory of sliding down the shale rock, just sliding down these steep slopes, trying to find our way to the path back to the bottom of the mountain. We were completely lost. I have no idea whether my parents planned the route, whether they looked at a map. Clearly it could have been planned a lot better and executed a lot better. You see, when adversity struck, we got lost. We got lost because we hadn't planned the route. We hadn't planned it out on a map. Now, in Israel's journey from Egypt to Canaan, we have recorded here in chapters 9 and 10 their first steps that they take after setting up the tabernacle. And in general, we've been seeing how Numbers provides a narrative of the people of God on their journey to the promised land. And we've also seen so far how it provides us with both warnings and examples for us as we live, if you like, between two places. We live in a place of journeying. We're on our way to a promised land. So it has something significant to teach us about how the people of God are to act and behave as we go on this journey to the promised land. And the first thing I want us to see from this Bible passage tonight is that we shouldn't forget where you have come from. Don't forget where you have come from. And we learn this from the remembrance of the Passover meal that we were thinking about with the children. Now, you may wonder, why is the Passover recorded here? Because if you look at the first verse, it says this was the first month of the second year after they came out of Egypt. But just going back a few chapters, back to right back at the beginning of Numbers, the account at the beginning of Numbers is on the first day of the second month. And yet now in chapter 9, we're back to the first month. Why are we learning about this here? Well, I think it's very important that whoever is reading Numbers, whether that was the ancient Israelites or us this evening, it's very important that we understand completely why they are going on this journey in the first place. And that's what this Passover account reminds us of. It reminds us of why they're going on this journey. Knowing where you came from is essential for making sure you're on the right path to your destination. You might have heard some people say something like, I'm never going to forget my roots. I'm never going to forget where I came from. And maybe it's some multimillionaire and they're saying that they came from the back of beyond, some unknown street in some unknown town. But I'm never going to forget where I came from. It's not like that, but what they're doing is they're saying, I'm so thankful of where I've come, where I am now. It's so different now from what it was then. But I'm never going to forget that, because when I compare what I have now with then, that's completely different. And that's what I like. It's disjointed from your roots. But actually, the Israelites here, as they remember the Passover, they're completely connected with their roots. Our roots determine our identity today. You see, the Passover reminds them that God is their root. God is their root. He's the root of the Israelites. He's the one who brought them out of Egypt, gave them their identity as free people, and he's with them still, and he's directing their path. And what we see is how important it is for the Israelites to celebrate the Passover. It's so important. Now, some people bring to Moses this problem of a dead body, don't they? Look down at verse 6 with me. But some of them could not celebrate the Passover on that day because they were ceremonially unclean on account of a dead body. To be unclean in this way meant separation from God's people. They had to go outside of the camp until evening if they became unclean in this way. We learned, I think was it last week or the week before, how being in contact with a dead body for someone who had taken the special vow, the special Nazarite vow, meant that that vow was cancelled because they became unclean. But what God answers to this question is it's so important that they are to celebrate the Passover, that even if they've become unclean from a dead body, they're still to celebrate the Passover. God does not want his people to ever forget their rescue. And even to be clean and not celebrate the Passover is far worse than being unclean and remembering the Passover. Look at verse 13. If a man who is ceremonially clean and not on a journey fails to celebrate the Passover, that person must be cut off from his people because he did not present the Lord's offering at the appointed time. That man will bear the consequences of his sin. There's severe consequences for neglecting the Passover. It's important. And this is why it's important. It's one reason. There's many. I'll just give you one this evening. It's important because the rescue reminds us who we are following. The rescue reminds us who we are following and who journeys with us. To remember that God led them out of Egypt is a reminder that he is also the God who leads them on. God didn't just make a path through the Red Sea. He goes before them and makes a path. Look at what Moses says at the end of chapter 10, verse 35. Rise up, O Lord, may your enemies be scattered, may your foes flee before you. God is making the path before his people. The cloud and the fire that ensured their safety through the Red Sea is now the cloud and fire above the tabernacle that leads them on. And you might have seen a small child walking through the grass, playing with their friends. They have a big stick and it's tall grass, and they're just hitting it aside. They're making a path so that everyone can follow. It's like that. God is making them a path for to lead them on to the promised land. He's no less leading them now than he was back as he took them through the Red Sea. Now, today, God doesn't lead us through our days with cloud and with fire. God doesn't use a cloud-based GPS system. Our path is not just spiritual, but God does organize our circumstances and our opportunities that we have, and he does lead us through a very real physical path of this life with a very specific spiritual purpose in mind. I want us to think back to what David knew of this. King David. David knew that he had God's help when he fought with bears, when he was guarding the flock. So he knew and he trusted God that he could stand before a giant with confidence. He knew that God would help him when he stood before a giant because he'd helped him when he stood before bears. Another example is what Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 4. Paul says this, but the Lord stood at my side and gave me strength, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. And I was delivered from the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil attack and will bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. Now, we sometimes think, well, the Old Testament is all about God's physical dealings with his people. The New Testament is just about the spiritual dealings. God is just interested in our spiritual state. But the reality is that God brings us through our spiritual lives as we live in physical, real-life circumstances every day. Now, whilst our confidence isn't the same as David's or Paul's, that our lives would be preserved from giants and lions, our confidence is that we will be taken safely to his heavenly kingdom. You see, Paul was someone who was stoned, wasn't he? And yet he could still say, "My God will rescue me from every evil attack." You see, an evil attack for us could be the temptation to grumble when we don't like the circumstances that God has dealt to us. It could be a refusal to trust God's timings when waiting for test results. Satan's attacks on us are thwarted when we honor God with our lips and our lives, and we remember who we are following. So don't ever forget where you have come from. Don't forget where you have come from. The second thing I want us to see from this Bible passage tonight is that we need to look where you are going. Look where you are going. So we've done looking backwards. Now we're looking forwards. And we're looking forwards, also looking backwards. Because we see that looking forwards, there's a past guarantee of what is ahead. I hope I can make this clear to you. The Israelites were saved from Egypt with a purpose. This is what we were thinking about with the children. This was the beginning of God working out his plan. He promised it to Abraham, and now generations later, he's acting on that promise as he brings his people into freedom through the Red Sea. Is this the point he's going to give up on his people? No. God will make it happen. When you think of the cross, in a sense, the cross is only the beginning. The end of our salvation is still to come. God has promised that all who trust in the death of his Son for their salvation will be saved. Jesus has died, he's risen, and he's ascended into heaven. And here tonight, this evening, are God's people who are trusting in the death of God's Son for their salvation. Is this the time when all God's promises are going to fail? Are going to come to nothing? Is tonight the night when God will say, "That's it, I'm done, no more"? No. Romans chapter 5. Since we have now been justified by his blood, how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? For if when we were God's enemies, we were reconciled to him through the death of his Son, how much more, having been reconciled, shall we be saved through his life? I haven't experienced this myself. I've witnessed it. Some of you will have experienced this. Giving birth to a child, it's filled with so much anticipation, many months, 9 months of anticipation, waiting for that moment, hours of labour. And at that point, can you go back on that choice? No. That's the time where you say, "No, let's finish this. This is the time. This is the time." And God, with our salvation, has gone through promising it to Abraham. He took his people out of Egypt. He's taken them to the promised land. He sent Jesus Christ as our Saviour. Is he going to give up on that plan? No. He's going to bring it to full fruition. Looking back reminds us of the certainty of our future. So look back. And that's why we repeat the drama of God's salvation so many times in our services. We rehearse it, we repeat it. So whether it's the Lord's Supper to remind us of Jesus' blood and body paying the price for our sin, or whether it's in our prayers as we confess our sin and ask for forgiveness, or whether it's in the songs that we sing each week, we rehearse the drama of God's salvation because we need to look back. We need to remind ourselves because that's what guarantees the future. That's what guarantees the future. Jesus himself commanded that we should continually remember, but only for a time, until he comes. Until he comes. So look where you are going, because there's a past guarantee. But also look where you are going, because there's a future promise. There's a future promise. Now in our Bible passage tonight, God gives the Israelites some clear indications that they will eventually be in their own land. The first one takes you a little bit unawares. It's as God is answering the problem about being unclean from a dead body. And what God says is that they can celebrate the Passover if they're unclean from a dead body, but also if they're away on a journey. If they're away on a journey. That implies they have to have a home to journey away from, doesn't it? They're already journeying at the moment as they're going to the promised land. But he's saying if ever you are away from home on a journey, you must still celebrate the Passover. It's a little hint. A further indication is the language in verse 14. Look down at verse 14. And God says, an alien living among you who wants to celebrate the Lord's Passover must do so in accordance with its rules and regulations. You must have the same regulations for the alien and the native born. This hints at a time when Israel will be established and strangers will be living among them. They've just come from Egypt, haven't they? Where they were the aliens. They were the strangers. But now they're going to a land where they will be the native. There will be native-born children. And there will be aliens and strangers among them. They didn't know what it was to be a native. But now, they will have a place where they can call home. There's further glimpses. Look, in chapter 10, and we read of these silver trumpets. They were to make these silver trumpets for the use of the Levites. Now, they had a very practical use, didn't they? You probably thought after all that standing up and making camp and moving and stopping, whether just for a night or for a month, how on earth were they going to organize people? It's very practical to have trumpets so they could send a signal out to everybody that it was time to go. So they were practical, but also they were there for celebration. So look, verse 8 of chapter 10. The sons of Aaron, the priests, are to blow the trumpets. This is to be a lasting ordinance for you and the generations to come. When you go into battle in your own land against an enemy who is oppressing you, sound a blast on the trumpets. Then you will be remembered by the Lord your God and rescued from your enemies. Also at your times of rejoicing, your appointed feasts and new moon festivals, you are to sound the trumpets over your burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, and they will be a memorial for you before your God. I am the Lord your God. So that the trumpets would sound for conquest, and they would sound for celebration. But they were to get them ready now. God doesn't say, when you're just about to go into the promised land, make these trumpets so you can blow them in battle. He says, make them now. They were going to carry these through their whole journey. And as they heard this trumpet blast to signal the moving of the camp, or to signal the sacrifices or a celebration, they could say to each other, can you imagine what it would be like to hear that trumpet in our own land? Can you imagine? One day we'll be home and that trumpet will blast in our own land and God himself will come and save us. He will give that land to us. It's a little bit like getting something ready for Christmas or a birthday. You get it ready in advance. You've bought the present and you prepare it. And it's so exciting. It's so exciting. It helps you to look forward to that time, doesn't it? Maybe it's putting up lights around your house or putting up the Christmas tree. It helps you to look forward to that day, to a preparation for it. And for us now, we have glimpses of life in that final promised land to help us keep our eyes fixed on it. It's our prayer that our services are a sound of heaven, a foretaste of countless voices joined together in praise and worship. Our meals together each Sunday are a foretaste of heaven. We rest from our work. We spend time with God's people. There will be a day of rest where we will never have to part from God's people, where we will be able to celebrate together forever in constant praise and rejoicing. So, the first two things I want us to learn from this passage are: don't forget where you have come from, and look where you are going. Thirdly and finally, though, we need to follow the Lord's commands. So we've looked back, we've looked ahead, and now we're looking down at our feet to watch where we're walking on the path. You see, it not only matters that you get there, it matters how you get there. And it mattered for the people of God, because once they got to that land, they were meant to live as one people, living under the rule of one God. And now imagine if on their way, they each picked their own route to get to the promised land, and they all ignored the route that God was taking them. Well, that's exactly how they would then live when they got there, wouldn't it? They wouldn't get there as one people. They would be getting there in disobedience to God, if they got there at all. Maybe some would arrive, some wouldn't arrive. They'd wander off to other lands. No, they had to follow God's route, so they would be one people under God's rule. Imagine two people preparing to get married. Imagine they're engaged, they're planning their wedding. They learn how to relate to each other in helpful ways. But if during their preparation they're always arguing and fighting, then their marriage is not going to go well. See, it doesn't just matter that one day they will be married, it matters how they prepare themselves for it. Another illustration. If doing an undergraduate degree is preparation for a career, then it's important how studious you are in the lectures and in the tutorials. You can't expect to just scrape through a degree and then be diligent once you're in the workplace, can you? No, how you get there determines how you will act in the workplace. So, let's look at how obedient the Israelites were. Let's have a look in this Bible passage how they got there. Well, we have here a good example to follow. The Israelites were obedient. Chapter 9, verse 7. They wanted to take part in the Passover in an acceptable way. So verse 7, they knew that becoming unclean because of a dead body would mean that they would be kept from keeping it. But they want to keep the Passover. So they ask Moses, what can we do about this? The whole account of following this cloud shows us how obedient the Israelites were in this way. There's a repeated phrase, at the Lord's command, at the Lord's command. They set out at the Lord's command. They camped at the Lord's command. Whatever the cloud did, wherever the cloud moved, they followed. And then look down to verse 13 of chapter 10, where we have the account of them actually taking their first steps in their different divisions. They set out this first time at the Lord's command through Moses. They were very obedient. Very obedient. The first characteristic of their obedience is that it was unified. It was unified. They responded as an entire people, didn't they? They each had a part to play. That account at the end of chapter 10, where they're going out in their divisions, and the different Levitical, the Levite people are carrying the parts of the tabernacle and the holy things. That's all happening according to God's instructions. They were each doing their little part, but they were moving as one people, as God wanted them to do. they wouldn't be able to meet with God, would they, if they didn't each do their part? If the tabernacle wasn't set up when the Kohathites got there with the holy things, what were they going to do? They had to make sure it was set up. Now, as God's people today, there should be a characteristic behaviour about us. Now, it doesn't mean having the same hairstyle, doesn't mean having the same clothing, but onlookers should be able to look at us as God's people and see a family resemblance manifested according to each of our individual circumstances, responsibilities or roles or personalities. They should see within us a love for God and a daily dependence upon Him, following wherever God leads in obedience and trust. They should see us setting our eyes beyond the things of this world, not living for the things that this world loves, but living for the things that God has promised us. We should be moving as one body of God's people towards the promised land. So, the obedience was unified. The second characteristic of this obedience was that it was unquestioning. It was unquestioning. Within this Bible passage, there is no complaints or questioning of the Israelites about why do we have to do it this way. Their question at the beginning of chapter 9 is merely they want to do it the right way and they want help. Now, their obedience was unquestioning, not because it didn't make sense and God was just saying, well, look, you've got to do it, you've got to do it. Their obedience made complete sense. So they knew that it didn't need questioning. God was taking them from slavery to freedom. He knew the way to get them there. Imagine with me, there's an account in Acts chapter 12 of Peter being led out of prison by an angel. Now the angel comes to Peter in the cell and he's chained to two guards. Yet the angel leads him out of that cell, leads him through two other gates, beyond the prison, and then down another street, far away from the prison. Now, Peter knew that he could trust that angel to lead him out. The angel wasn't going to lead him out of his cell to a dead end, or down a pathway that he couldn't walk along. He knew that the angel was his way to escape, that what he had started, he would finish. His following was unquestioning, because he knew that that was the right way to go. So, coming back to the Israelites, it made complete sense for the Israelites to exactly follow the cloud. There was no reason to question. God had led them this far with a purpose, so the pathway God would lead them in was going to be trustworthy and reliable. Now, in the New Testament, in 1 Corinthians, Paul uses this time of wandering of God's people as a warning to us against disobedience, against certain things. And just for a few minutes at the end, it would be helpful for us to turn to 1 Corinthians and chapter 10. In the Brown Bibles, you'll find that on page 1202. 1202. So 1 Corinthians chapter 10. And possibly the title in your Bible for chapter 10 will be Warnings from Israel's History. So verse 1. Paul says, I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers, that our forefathers were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. So the cloud there is the cloud that they followed through the desert, and the sea is a reference to the Red Sea. And then look down at verse 6. Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and got up to indulge in pagan revelry. We should not commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 of them died. We should not test the Lord as some of them did, and were killed by snakes. And do not grumble as some of them did, and were killed by the destroying angel. These things happened to them as examples, and were written down as warnings for us, on whom the fulfillment of the ages has come. What we've been learning tonight is that we should be warned. We should be warned. There's a warning here against idolatry, against sexual sin, against testing God, against grumbling. We've seen in chapters 9 and 10 about the good obedience, the right obedience that the Israelites showed. But soon that was to change. And we need to be warned away from the attitude of thinking, I'm safe, so I don't need to make any efforts to be holy. You see, tonight we shouldn't be thinking, oh, well, we know what's round the corner for these foolish Israelites. They're just going to turn against God. Isn't that really sad? But that's not me. No, the purpose that we should take away is in verse 12 of 1 Corinthians chapter 10. So, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. I'd like each one of us tonight to consider, am I bearing straight? Do I have confidence in the God who rescued me in the past, that he will finish that work in the future? Am I looking forward to our eternal future with certainty and anticipation? Do I long for it? Am I turning away from my idols in the here and now? Do I shun sexual immorality? Do I think that I'm standing firm? Well, probably. We all think we're standing firm. Well, be careful that you don't fall. You've probably seen a child climb up onto a chair, or even a table or something higher, and they're balancing. And they think they're standing firm. They say, look, Daddy, look, Mummy. And what do you say? Be careful. Be careful. Yes, they're not falling yet. But you understand that they might fall and you want them to stand firm. So tonight, I want to say to you, if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. Let's make sure that we continue in obedience in the way that the Israelites did. Unquestioning, unified, looking back, looking forward, trusting the God who is leading us on. Jesus Christ, we are saved from sin because of his death and his resurrection. We look back to that. We have his promise that he is always with us. And we have his promise that one day we will enjoy that Passover meal of remembrance in the new heaven and the new earth with him. So let's look back, let's look ahead, and let's walk in the path that God is leading us in. Amen.